please feel free to continue with your delicious meal. What a treat. My name is Marla Sanger, for those who might not know me, and I am going to be stepping in for Adrienne tonight because they had a calendar conflict that she wasn't able to address another way, and so I'm here to serve. So I'll start by welcoming all of our committee members. Thank you for being here on this beautiful, warm, sunny day. Maybe it feels good to get in out of the heat. Thank you for being here. And I also have the pleasure of asking Dr. Melnick to introduce a new member of the Center for Public Health team. His name is Michael Kugler. And so Dr. Melnick, if you would please share a little bit about Michael and introduce him.
I'm delighted to introduce Michael Kugler. So when we took on the medical exam, we got a bit bigger. So we've actually reorganized our leadership team. So nobody's left. Janice is still Director of Environmental Public Health. Roxana's Healthy Communities.
Good enough. That's good. That'll work. That's right.
Jeff is Director of Administrative Services. Hopefully I'm getting everybody's job right. So Michael will be, underneath him will be communicable disease, including STD and HIV, our fee for public health emergency preparedness program, and the medical examiner. So Michael comes to us with many years of experience in preparedness. He was more recently, for the last, what, 7 years?
7 years.
Emergency manager or emergency response manager for the Providence Health System in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm getting that right. Michael also has a whole lot of communicable disease experience. He was with the U.S. Navy. And while working in the Navy, and I'm sure I'm hopefully getting this all correct, he was responsible for communicable disease control in Iceland, as well, and has great stories, as well as you're involved with communicable disease control in the Indian Ocean region as well. So he's got, you know, the Navy gave him, and you know, one of the great things about the Navy is, you know, you got a population that you're responsible for, so you learn a lot about population health. So he's got that. The medical examiner piece may be a little bit new, but Michael's, you know, well positioned to be overseeing this program. So.
Thank you.
I don't know if you want to say anything else.
Oh, just thank you all for letting me join you this evening. Thanks.
Thank you very much for doing that. I also want to introduce to our members here a guest that's been with us tonight. I don't see any members of the public here to comment, so I will introduce Brett Bass, who is the Program Coordinator for Safer Homes Suicide Aware Program, and he'll be presenting to us tonight and facilitating a discussion about gun safety and suicide prevention, which is something that we've been really talking a lot about and really trying to think about how can we become more involved in doing something that will improve, you know, our world as it relates to preventing suicides and the role that guns have in that. So we're looking forward to hearing from you, Brett, and thank you so much for coming to spend this evening with us. I really appreciate it. I think what I'll do from that point is just start around the room and have everyone introduce themselves and what your role is on the advisory, Public Health Advisory Council. So I've introduced you, Brett, and maybe Roxanne.
I'm Roxanne Wolf. I'm the Director of Community Health for Clark County Public Health.
And I'm Lydia Gurman, Administrative Assistant with Clark County Public Health.
And I'm Mike.
I'm Katie, the Clark County Youth Representative.
I'm Dave Fuller. I'm the Director for Clark Regional Emergency Services.
Stephanie, and I'm a nurse practicing in Clark County.
And I'm Marla Sanger, and I am representing Consumers of Public Health Services.
I'm Arlene Thursday, and I represent medical doctors practicing in Clark County.
Jeff Harbison, I'm the Administrative Services Director of Clark County Public Health.
Alan Melnick, Public Health Director and Health Officer.
I'm Paul Childers, and I represent the restaurants of Clark County. I'm Charlotte O'Gord. I represent the educational community and the principal of Ballard High School.
John Roth, Clark County Public Water Providers, Clark County Public Utilities.
Dave Scott, City Manager, City of West Yugal, and I'm a local resident of Clark County Cities and Towns.
And I'm Bob Richardson, the Police Chief of Ballard, and I represent the Law Enforcement Council, which is all the police chiefs and the sheriff.
Thanks, everyone. The next order of business is to ask if everyone's had a chance to read our prior minutes from our last meeting, which was on June 25th. And then we do have a quorum, I understand, so that we can go ahead and approve the minutes with a vote. So I'm going to ask for a motion and a second. Paul Childers.
Approved.
Second.
Thank you. And so all in favor of approving?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carried. Thank you. I have an announcement to make that you'll all probably be well aware of. I was very grateful myself to have received information about the passing of one of our members, Melanie Mayorino. She's been on the our committee since 2016, and she has been a tireless advocate for behavioral health, for care and treatment of people who are dealing with mental health and behavioral health disorders. She has served as an office for the Southwest Washington Behavioral Health Services for many years. And she's also a very passionate advocate for trauma-informed practices throughout our community. And we have a condolence card that I'm going to pass around if you'd like to just sign it so we can share it with her loved ones. And I just for one to say I'm really personally going to miss her spunk. Mm-hmm. I really felt like she was a very special person and very brave, and that she brought something unique to this group that will be impossible to replace. So I think we'll all miss her. So I will start this card around, and then we'll start over here, and then we'll send it back. The next thing that we'll be talking about, and this is going to be audience participation, and this has to do with a proposed schedule change. And so if you have a chance to look at your packet, there is a proposed bylaw amendment that is going to involve schedule change. The notice of the bylaw amendment went out on August 19th. And a copy of the proposal is attached to your agenda. And it's the proposal is to consider making a change to our meeting schedule by changing it to every 2 months instead of every month. And this would go effective, providing that after the 21-day notice, that we would have a vote of two-thirds affirmative. This would go into effect, and this can be done by email, so that is what we're planning to do. So additionally, we're proposing a change to the attendance language as outlined in the proposal as well. And the change around the attendance relates to the fact that the meetings would be going from almost, 11 to 12 a year down to 6 a year. So if somebody misses a meeting, that's a big proportion of the total number of meetings in a year, and missing two in a row would mean a very large gap in their participation. So that is the reason why there's going to be a change in the attendance policy too. And the attendance policy relates to people who have unexcused absences. So if something comes up that a person needs to be absent and they have conversation about it, let Roxanne know or Dr. Miller, that would be a different situation. It refers to unexcused absences. So we're we're formally not voting on that tonight because we do need to have this 21 day of advance notice so people have a chance to think about it. However, we will be requesting this email vote after the 21 day notice has come up, and that will be September 16th. But for tonight, what we would like to have is some of your reactions, ideas, thoughts, suggestions, and just some conversation about good idea, bad idea, what you see as benefits to it, or maybe some concerns that you might have about it. So I'll just open the floor for comments.
Not only had one comment, that was the day it changes to Wednesday, and I have a problem with that as far as my work is concerned. Off on Monday, Tuesday would be an issue.
Okay.
So did you say that Tuesdays works obviously for you now, but
it works for me now. Yes. Thank you. I could possibly see about getting Wednesdays off, but it falls suit to the work schedule is Monday, Tuesday. So.
Okay, thank you.
What about Thursday, Paul?
Pardon?
Thursday?
Well, I'm off on Monday and Tuesday.
Oh, got it. Okay. You're working. Got it. Understood. Okay. Okay.
Are they commenting on keeping the time the same?
Yeah.
Right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of the, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background. So we've been getting a lot of feedback about our meetings. And, you know, in prior years, there were some things that we did as a committee. For instance, the Growing Healthier Report was one of those things. And there's been several other things that you all have been very active in. Part of the benefit of having a larger staff is that we were able to do a lot of, a lot of work around that. So with the Growing Healthier Report, we had, you know, a few people that were working on that pretty much full time. We don't have that, you know, the benefit of having that much of a staff anymore. However, I do know that there's a lot of folks on FAC that are very interested in specific topics. So the idea would be that if we go to a two-month meeting schedule, there may be opportunities to have ad hoc work committees for things that come up that FAC members might be interested in, where we would have a public health facilitator, and then FAC members could join that and come up with some ideas to bring back to the full FAC committee to review. So we'll still have some of those opportunities to really get more involved and in the weeds for some of you that would like to do that. But we would also continue to have the educational component of these meetings, which has also been well received. But we don't want these meetings just to be educational only, because part of the role of FAC is to advise the Board of Health. And so it's nice to also have opportunities to really look at policy level things where you can advise the Board of Health. So the idea would be every two-month meetings, ad hoc meetings as we need to with those work groups and with interested FAC members. And then if there's some big issue that comes up that we need to convene you all, we could do that as well. We could have special meetings. But over a period of time, it would just be every 2 months. We would still come together with very similar topics. We'll still have our educational topics, as well as feedback on legislative issues and budget and all of that stuff, and then opportunities for you all to weigh in your advocacy role as well. So that was kind of the background and the reason why we kind of landed where we did.
Okay. Other comments or concerns?
Is there any particular reason we're looking at Wednesdays rather than Tuesdays?
Well, the Board of, the Clark County Council has, when do
first,
they meet?
They meet the
first and third.
First and third
Tuesdays. That's why we
Tuesdays.
Moved to the fourth. We moved to the fourth Tuesday. So So they used to meet every Tuesday in the morning. And then they changed their meeting schedule to be the first and third Tuesday evening. So most of the council members, aside from the chair, are part-time council members, and they have other jobs. So. They moved, and it's also easier for constituents to get there in the evening as well if they're working. So they moved to the first and third Tuesdays. That's why we moved this meeting to the fourth Tuesday. Roxanne, I don't know if you were going to say something else.
We can certainly, I don't know that there was any reason for Wednesdays other than just some dialogue that's nice in the middle of the week. So I do think that if Tuesdays are still better, we could certainly make an amendment to the proposal that went out. And continue to have this on fourth Tuesday. Yes, Jeff.
I think one of the reasons we went to the first or second was the Christmas holiday. I think towards the end of the year.
Yeah.
We can actually go on the second Tuesday instead of the first Tuesday.
That's right.
And avoid Clark County Council as well as holidays late in the year. We've had trouble getting quorum.
That's right. Okay.
Christmas and Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So we wanted to be earlier in the month rather than later in the month to avoid those. But the second Tuesday would work.
Okay. Okay. So what we would need to do is, as when we put, after your 21-day notice, which will be on or around September 16th, we'll be sending out an email to you all to vote, formally vote on this. What we can do is we can note in the notes that there would be a request to make this the second Tuesday of the month, okay, and we can change the proposal, and that's what we'll vote on, unless anybody has any concerns about that.
Second Tuesday, okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Very good.
That was... Okay, the next thing that we have on the agenda is Jeff Harbison will give us a quick update on the budget.
Hello. Okay. Not a lot has happened since I spoke to you last. We submitted our budget. We are confident we'll be receiving additional Melton sales tax funding to again expand our discount partnership program. There were fewer requests than dollars available, so something very, very positive for us there. We don't have any asks for additional county general fund. Our budget should be approved as submitted, is my assumption. So just holding tight at the moment. The council has to approve a balanced budget the first full week of December. That's in the code, so the statute actually.
Any questions for Jeff? Thank you very much. And Roxanne, you have offered to share some information about Healthier Washington, the Medicaid transformation program.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I believe that you all had something. Yeah, somebody, sounds like somebody's rattling the doorknob over there. We had, I believe some of this information might have gone out to you via email, but there's a public forum that's going to be happening in Vancouver. On September 26th at the Bridgeview Resource Center, which is right off of Mill Plain. And it's called the Healthier Washington Medicaid Transformation 2019 Public Forums. And what this is, it's sponsored by Southwest Accountable Community of Health and the Healthcare Authority. And they're opening this up to have some public dialogue around some of the transformation projects that they're currently working on for Medicaid right now. They're going to be talking a lot about those programs, talking about what they're doing, opening it up for public comment, and just sharing with the public what they've been doing. It's also an opportunity to have people outside of the Southwest Accountable Community of Health or Healthcare Authority, of folks that are usually at the table, to come and share information about sort of what their experiences are to help inform some of that work. So the public forum is on the 26th of September. It'll be a link in your notes when they go out. If you're interested in going, it's from 6 to 8 that night. September 26th, I'm not sure. I can look at can see what day that is. Hold on. September 26th is a Thursday from 6 to 8. If you're interested in going, we'll have the link and you can RSVP directly. And if you haven't been to Bridgeview yet, it's really awesome. It's a really great resource center, fairly brand new, open to the public, but really, really great. So if you have an opportunity to go, it's going to be very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So it's not on the agenda, but can I make a couple of announcements? One is that we've hired a deputy health officer. Figured I'd let folks know. His name is Dr. Stephen Krager. He's board certified in public health and preventive medicine. He has a background. He's been a health officer for Columbia County in Oregon, and he's also done a fair amount of primary care. He wants to do public health, and he'll start on September 16th, and that will help us provide health officer services to Skamania, Cowlitz, and Wakayakum counties, as well as Clark County. He'll also help me out, and he'll given that we'll have a deputy health officer 3 days a week, that will provide some additional support from the health officer piece of what I do. So the other, since I'm mentioning this to the Board of Health tomorrow, just really briefly, there's a statewide outbreak of hepatitis A going on, predominantly in a homeless population. Spokane, King County, I think Ponderay, there's rural counties involved as well. So we're looking at providing hepatitis A vaccine in our harm reduction center, as well as the STD HIV clinic that we operate with Cascade ACE Project. We're actually talking to the free clinic about possibly providing hepatitis A vaccine at the share house, and we're still having those conversations going. I don't know if anybody wants to add anything to that, but I figured I'd let folks know.
I've got a question, Doctor. What's the impact for first responders and something like that when dealing with the homeless population?
Well, so hepatitis A is spread by the fecal-oral route, so that's a risk factor. So, you know, this is one thing where hand washing is a really good thing. You can prevent it. But there's no reason why healthcare, people work in the healthcare industry shouldn't get Hep A vaccine as well. So Hep A vaccine is really effective. But, you know, one of the other things we need to have conversations about it as a community, and, you know, this might be something of interest to FAC, is, you know, how we can improve the hygiene or the opportunities for hygiene in that population. You know, hand washing facilities somewhere, bathrooms that people can use, you know, something that, you know, we need to think about. But, you know, getting people vaccinated would really, the other information we've got is gotten out is to the clinics and the emergency departments and put a provider advisory out that if you, you know, if you're in an emergency department, you're encountering somebody with who's homeless, you know, who's in a risk factor, go ahead and give them the hepatitis A vaccine and don't even worry about whether you can determine whether they've been vaccinated before or not. It doesn't hurt to get additional vaccine. You know, stool sitting there on the ground isn't going to put you at risk. It's, you know, somehow, sorry to be so graphic while we're having dinner here, but it's a matter of, you know, getting it to the mouth.
Well, I know that, you know, they've got problems in some of the cities where they step in stuff, the officers step in stuff.
Stepping in stuff is okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you just got to keep it out of your mouth.
Well, you step in stuff, you go back to your locker, you pull your shoes off.
Yeah.
You wash your hands.
Yeah, so that's the kind of stuff that they're having issues with. So
yeah.
I just want to be able to put something out to the
hand washing, if you, you know, hand washing before you eat, the, you know, it doesn't hurt if you're out in the field, you know, whenever you can, wash your hands. You can, you know, you can take the gel, you know, whatever you call it, along with you.
That's what we carry.
You can carry it with you. You should know that, you know, it works, but it's not quite as effective as soap and water because it doesn't get rid of as much of the organic material, the graphic that's sitting there. But hand washing is, you can completely prevent hepatitis A by frequent hand washing.
Gloves
and all that, yeah.
And we'd be happy to give you some message points if you want.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And I can send it to the LEC and they can,
yep.
We can put it out to our officers and
yep.
Maybe step by eye, this is going on in the state, so.
Yeah, we've got a lot of our PIO, Marissa Armstrong, has been putting some things together, so we're happy to share. Okay. Yeah.
And vaccination.
Gloves are helpful, but after removing the gloves, then the folks still need to wash their hands.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the hand gel is not, as you said, not as effective as hand washing for certain things. I'm noticing that in some of the newer outdoor public restrooms, they have hand gel station, but there's no running water. So
mm-hmm. They need soap and water.
Yeah.
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 We would never let that suffice in a restaurant, you know, soap and water. And, you know, realize that some folks are most folks who are homeless are working. You know, they just can't afford. Some of them are working in the food industry. So getting that population vaccinated is really critical.
Yeah. All right.
Is it getting to be enough of a prevalence in the community that it should be a vaccination that everybody just gets, or is it just...
Well, certainly if you're traveling to certain areas, you know, where hepatitis A is prevalent, you should be vaccinated. But I don't think we're there. You know, certainly we need to concentrate on the homeless population. I've been vaccinated for Hep A. I don't travel. Well,
great questions. Thanks.
So before we move on to our presenter, are there any other updates that Jeff, you, or Dr. Melvin, or Wilson, or Michael, or anyone else that you want to bring up here? I'm not talking about our round table with the members, but the public health team. Anything else? Then, Mr. Brett Bass, I'm back to you, and I would again thank you for being here. And maybe before you start your presentation, if you could just tell a little bit about yourself, maybe what has really prompted your interest in this area, and then we'll really enjoy hearing your presentation and learning more about your organization. Thank you.
Sure. So, I'm Brett. I'm Brett Bass. I work for Forefront Suicide Prevention. I'm the program coordinator for Safer Home Suicide Aware, which is one of the three programmatic outreaches that we have in that organization. So, I've worked there in a formal capacity for a little over a year now. I was recruited into the Safer Homes Task Force before day one. So, I got my foot in the door doing this because, in addition to my work at Forefront, I'm also a rifle and pistol marksmanship instructor for Bellevue Gun Club. I spent the last 13 years in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve. I got out on the 25th of April of this year and promptly stopped shaving, hence the somewhat lackluster beard and mustache that I have right now. I stubble well. I don't necessarily beard well, so it's a work in progress. I do apologize. In that capacity, technically, I served as a military policeman. I like to say technically because I was never assigned to the provost marshal's office, which means I have never written a speeding ticket. I have never responded to a domestic dispute. And as a result, I was principally trained as a field MP to man crew-served weapons, drive armored vehicles, operate entry control points, and things of that nature. So I did a lot of that, plus some really strange ancillary work when I was deployed. I've been to Latvia, Kuwait, Afghanistan, very briefly to Kyrgyzstan, a country I did not necessarily know existed until shortly prior to my arrival. It was actually a really cool experience, and I mean that both metaphorically and literally, because it was about 12 degrees the whole time I was there. So I'm very grateful the time that I was able to contribute with that. So in 2016, I wound up going through a rather unpleasant breakup, and the owner of the range that I work at hates the limelight and knew that I needed something else to do. So he said, hey, I got invited by the King County and Seattle Public Health Department to represent the firearms industry on this panel about firearms and suicide, and I don't want to do it. Would you like to? And so in slightly more colorful language, I said, screw it, why not? Sure. And so I went to the panel, and there were about 300 or 400 people there. I didn't know any of them. I felt very much as though I was a uncooked T-bone steak walking to a room full of coyotes, and was on a panel with Jen Stuber, who's the Center Director for Forefront Suicide Prevention, Dr. Fred Rivara, who has written a lot of seminal articles on this topic for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Jeff Sun, who's now a close friend of mine, who at the time was the president of the Washington State Psychiatric Association, a couple other people who are very big, and I didn't know any of them. And then there was me, some random guy representing the gun business. And so after all the keynote speakers had done their thing, the very first question to the panel was presented, and a woman stood up and said, well, how do we talk to those people that have their guns, and how do we get through to them about the things that they should do? And sort of went on along that series of statements for a while, and I asked if I could take the question. And everybody on the panel, there's like a line of them sort of, you know, this guy. And so they gave me the microphone. I said, I think there are two serious problems. The first is that the phrasing you've used about them and they is essentially like taking a big hand and going like, those people. And I said, in Washington State, something almost 40% of people own firearms. Nationally, it's about 1 out of 3. This is not a small minority of people. And the other part is you guys are public health experts, but you have absolutely no idea how to talk to anybody within my community. And I said, just as a show of hands here, who in the audience has a firearm? Two hands go up. I then said, how many people in this room can tell me the 4 universal rules to safe firearms handling? One hand goes up. And I said, this is a serious problem. Like, we can't talk about suicide prevention without also talking about firearms. And we can't talk about firearms without also talking about suicide. But the trick is, everyone that knows everything that they possibly could in King County about public health has absolutely no cultural competence. This is not a blue versus red team nonsense partisan issue. This is a public health crisis, and I got a standing ovation out of it. So Jen Stuber, who runs Forefront, corners me. If you know her, and has anyone actually met her before? I'll be very charitable. She is a very type A personality, and she's very good at getting what she wants. Corners me, literally corners me, and says, I need you on my task force. And I said, there's a task force? And so I got represented to be one of the two, I got elected to be one of the two representatives of the firearms industry on the Safer Homes Task Force. And now that I actually work for Forefront, I ironically no longer have an actual vote on the task force itself. So the same year, the state legislature passed a bill which created the Safer Homes Task Force, which has since been amended to be the Safer Homes Suicide Aware Task Force. So various stakeholders to include representatives of the law enforcement community, Sergeant Ryan Tanner, who was here momentarily and then got promptly snatched up to go do law enforcement related things, is our most recently recruited member thereof. And he is a crisis negotiator for the Washington State Patrol stationed here out of the city of Vancouver. So that's sort of what we're doing and why, and that's where I come from. So I like to open all of my presentations with a bad joke, and I promise it is safely above the belt. That way, if my presentation stinks, at least there's one thing worse, and if it's hilarious, then at least you guys get one chuckle out of it. So I was thinking about getting into fashion design, and I was inspired by Flava Flav, that big clock he wears around his neck, so I built a belt out of wristwatches, but I gave the whole thing up because it was just a giant waste of time. I structured my presentation.
he loves it. He's a punster right there.
We're going to get along great. So I structured my presentation in the form of a five-paragraph operations order. The acronym is SMEAC. So situation, sort of what brings us here. Most of you guys are probably already familiar with a lot of this data. I do apologize. I suspect that one of our versions of PowerPoint wasn't the same, and so the actual statistics didn't translate over, except for 68%? Mm-hmm. Why did that? Okay, well, we got one of them. This is what death looks like, broadly speaking, in Washington State. This is from the CDC's WSCARS, which is an excellent tool for those lay people in the room, which I am a member. We can look at unintentional things, injuries, accidents, whatever. This is, of course, the preponderance, but suicide is roughly one out of five fatalities in Washington State. As per the AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, suicide has moved from being the 10th leading cause of death in Washington in 2016 to being the 8th leading cause of death today, making it competitive with heart disease, which is somewhat frightening. This is the means that people select for suicide in Washington State, again, for the same span of time, 2007 to 2017, as per CDC WSCARS. Just barely over half, it's 50.1%, is from self-inflicted gunshot. The green value percentage there, of course, is suffocation, and the next is drug poisoning. Various other types of poisoning sort of be combined in the work that we do. Firearms are essentially the most lethal common method for suicide in the United States. There is one more lethal method, but it's essentially statistically unknown, and that's self-immolation. It is horrifyingly common in South Asia. It's the act of lighting oneself on fire. That's about the only thing that's more lethal than shooting yourself. So some of the folks that I've met through the Seattle and King County Public Health Department did a really fascinating sort of cross-comparison between people who own firearms and don't. The actual rate of suicidality between people that own guns and people who do not own guns is not statistically different. The trick is when you select to shoot yourself, you will probably die something like 85 to 90% of the time, which is why that is so large. And then one of the things I was just talking to Roxanne about, I love data. I love comparing things. One of the interesting trends is in comparing data about suicide means from 2001 to present, or at least as current as CDC keeps reference for. Self-inflicted gunshot has actually diminished slightly in percentage, and suffocation has increased. And I can only theorize, or I guess hypothesize, why that might be. It could be that the basal rate for suicide attempts amongst people with firearms access has already sort of reached saturation, and it could be that our emergency medical response has gotten better at treating poisoning, and suffocation is eating a larger percentage of that as a consequence and a substitution effect, but I'm uncertain why that is precisely. So this is firearm deaths. So if you've ever heard somebody, this is a phrase that is in the common parlance, especially today, which is gun violence. In our opinion, that is an insufficiently specific term because everything on this pie chart is gun violence. But the solutions to all of these things are entirely different. So for example, if we wanted to reduce the number of people who were shot and killed in self-defense by police officers, this is what's called legal intervention per the CDC. It's actually significantly less than 1%, just for whatever reason these populations round the closest integer. That's a very different conversation than what we're going to do if we're going to try to reduce accidental firearm injuries and deaths. It's worth noting that the rate of accidental firearm injury and death is actually at a near historic low. So the CDC has kept statistics on this. There's a correlation, and if you're in my industry, you know Colonel Jeff Cooper. Well, yes. So he created what's known as the modern technique of defensive pistol shooting in 1967 when he founded the American Pistol Institute, or API, which went on to become Gunsight, which is the sort of first institutionalized gunfighting school that I know of in the world. In addition to putting those techniques together, he also standardized the four universal rules of safe firearms handling, which I mentioned earlier. And the CDC started keeping statistics on these things in 1968, and every year since 1970, the rate of accidental firearm injury death rates have precipitously declined. So we can see that institutionalization of safety parameters has at least arguably shown to correlate strongly with a significant reduction in accidental firearm-related fatalities. The Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, for example, showed a 1970 high water mark on an annual basis between that decade. There were just shy of 500 mishaps with firearms in the hunting season that would result in property damage, injury, or fatality, and is now a statewide scandal if more than 50 take place. So the rate has just gone like an upside-down hockey stick. So if we're going to reduce the number of people that die from being shot, we have to talk about suicide prevention. We absolutely have to. And I think there's gaining momentum sort of culturally that this is a topic that we can all talk about and really sort of move forward with. So when we start looking at demographics, we can see that the largest, by overall numbers and percentage, people at risk for suicide are men in the middle years. There is an interesting tendency, and Jeff Sung is not here, so I have to sort of give him a voice. As somebody who specializes in suicide prevention work, he highlights the fact that roughly 70% of the funding for suicide prevention goes to youth suicide, which is approximately 7% of fatalities. So I find that worth highlighting. One of the reasons there's such a strong discrepancy in gender as it pertains to suicide fatality is, of course, the means selection. Women actually attempt suicide at a higher rate than men, but they overwhelmingly select less lethal means, poisoning by a tremendous majority, whereas men tend to shoot themselves. And of course, as we discussed, shooting yourself is substantially more fatal than any sort of poisoning. There are other sort of risk factors involved. For example, dentists, medical doctors, and veterinarians select poisoning at a higher rate than self-inflicted gunshot. This could be due to lack of access to those means. The other part could also be greater knowledge of how those medicines can be used in overdose to actually result in fatality. Because somebody walking into Walgreens, grabbing a bottle of ibuprofen, and downing the whole thing is very rarely fatal. This is based on a Seattle Times story I read back in April. But still, that's sort of what we have. That's the situation. Veterans represent a specifically high-risk group, and veterans are actually sort of symptomatic of a number of professions. So veterans have the highest profile of all of these things because they're a particularly sympathetic group. People that have served the armed forces of the United States are also subjected to high degrees of stress, although a lot of the stressors may not necessarily be obvious. An interesting sort of piece of trivia, roughly 46% of active duty suicides are junior enlisted members on their first enlistment who have never deployed. So the stereotypical response of like, why do I think somebody who's in the armed forces killed themselves, multiple combat deployments, they couldn't handle moral injury, et cetera, may apply in some cases, but is not necessarily most indicative of what of that sort of stress looks like. We can see that self-inflicted gunshot is more common amongst the veteran community. This also correlates strongly with a higher rate of firearms ownership. It's about half of veterans have firearms, whereas in the general population, as I mentioned, in Washington State, it's not quite 40%. Nationally, it's somewhere in the ballpark of about one out of three Americans. So about 20% of all suicide fatalities are people who have served our nation in uniform at some point, which is sort of a very sad number. Anyway, what's our mission? So Dr. Jen Stuber, who runs Forefront, lost her husband to a firearm-involved suicide several years ago. And through her navigating the labyrinth of violent death, she wound up cold calling, of all organizations, the NRA. It's the largest advocacy organization for people who own firearms. Said, what are you guys doing about this? And they said, like, we really don't know what to do, essentially, over a very heated series of conversations. And this sort of gave rise to the partnership that we have right now. The idea is, if we're going to reduce the rate with which people who own guns kill themselves, we have to meet them where they are. And so the Safer Homes organization was put together, and the idea is we only work in areas where we have common ground, because we do have a broad tent, and there are a lot of people with some ideas that are mutually exclusive on different topics, but we're not going to discuss those within the task force work that we do. So what we're trying to do is improve what's called means safety. And means safety is somewhat modern, a relatively recent idea, the idea that we can encourage people to be safer with potentially lethal means. it's based on the idea of means restriction. I think the most influential study on this point was done with the Israeli Defense Force. They were experiencing a high rate of suicide off duty hours because it was a common practice at the time for IDF soldiers to take their issued service weapons, so their M16s, they would take home with them on the weekends due to the fact that they're sort of at an elevated risk of terror attack. After they started observing that the means that were most often used were people using their service rifles to shoot themselves, they opted to no longer allow IDF soldiers to take their firearms home from base on the weekend, and they saw a 40% diminishment in suicide fatality. So the society in which we live doesn't work in a command and control system. The firearms that even people in the armed forces use for suicide are overwhelmingly personally owned. It's actually very rarely service weapons that are used for this purpose. So we can't necessarily hoover them up or put them someplace, but we can educate people in how best to store them and what other practices they can do when they themselves or other people are potentially at risk. So we have a public awareness campaign. I have all the collateral materials, by the way, that we have generated to date over there if you'd like to take any of them with you. One more thing to note is we have a separate program called All Patients Safe. We're having a sponsorship through the 15th of September, so any that works in a clinical setting, we have an opportunity for you to take our training for free, and I have a brochure on that as well, so feel free. I wound up with one remaining one of those from a different event, and I figured I'd share it with you guys since there were actual providers here. So we have stickers we can put up in public places. This is kind of like the don't drink and drive stickers that you've almost certainly seen in restrooms, or the don't drink while pregnant ones you've seen in bars. And the new iteration of our sticker actually has the crisis hotline number on there, as well as some website information, so it's a product improved version. We tailor a suicide prevention training. If you're familiar with ASSIST or QPR, the equivalent of those that Forefront has put together is called LEARN. The acronym stands to look for warning signs, empathize and listen, ask directly about suicide, remove the danger. I prefer to say reduce access to lethal means, because if you work in a potentially dangerous profession, you can't remove all danger. And then move to next steps of care, and we can tailor that depending on if it's a setting in which there's a high degree of providers or if it's lay people. So I provide a large number of veteran-specific LEARN trainings to the Washington Department of Veterans Affairs. I just did one on Saturday in Ellensburg at their Vet Corps conference that they had in that setting. And of course, we can tailor this to whatever audience. So if we have a request from a large enough population, we can tailor the messaging that way. We're in the process of doing that for the construction industry, which has recently been included in the statute which governs safer homes. So this is interesting. I mentioned earlier the accidents thing. This is the beautiful upside down hockey stick. The sort of thought behind our work is if we decide that there's a correlation between the institutionalization of universal standards of safe behavior surrounding firearms and a significant decrease in the rate with which people are accidentally shot and killed, or just accidentally shot, period, we can use this same basic template to say, like, we can train people how to be safer when it comes to suicide risk as well. Because one of the things that we've encountered is when a provider asks someone, do you store your firearms safely? The word safe actually has at least three different meanings. So one of the most comprehensive studies on people that own firearms was done by the Pew Research Center in 2017. And what they found was slightly more than 2 out of 3 people that own firearms anymore do so for the purpose of personal safety. They want to make themselves safe from external attack. And the training that we provide, any firearms instruction, also includes the 4 universal rules of safe firearms handling, which is intended to make us safer from negligence. Right? We establish patterns of behavior in which there are left and right lateral limits, and things outside of that can lead to mishap, and as a result, they're unacceptable. When a provider is asking about this, what they're really getting at is, are you storing your firearms in such a way that if you are at risk, you do not have access to them for the purpose of suicide prevention? And so when a provider asks, do you store your firearms safely, the patient can sell it and say, absolutely yes, but they're thinking about 2 completely different things. So the patient is at least 2/3 of the time saying, yes, I store my firearms safely so I can protect myself and my family if I'm attacked, and I'm also storing it in such a way as to minimize the possibility of unintended access from unauthorized persons. What they are not thinking about is, what if I wind up in crisis? That's definitely not on the radar for the majority of people. Suicide is a relatively recent topic that's sort of the public consciousness. It's one of those things that the stereotypes we just don't talk about. We're starting to change that, but there's still a lot of baggage in the way. So we're trying to put on the radar a lot of like the risks that are associated with this thing. So how do we do this? Of course, we mentioned the fact that we have the LEARN training itself we provide to various communities, but what we're most famous for is the work that we do in gun shows, where we actually distribute locking equipment at no cost to the public. So the acronym we have, I'd like to apologize, I hate acronyms. I spent 13 years in the Marines, there's a lot of them, and I didn't write this one. So anytime you start with a word and kind of smash other things into that word to make the acronym make sense, I find it to be somewhat below average. So I didn't write this, but basically the way that we go about conducting one of these events in, for example, a gun show setting or a community event, is that we will signpost to get attention. Typically this is in the form of a literal sign. You can see it says raffle for a smart vault. So most of the time at a gun show setting, we'll purchase like a really nice high-end, like quick access gun safe or something electronic, maybe with a biometric lock or something, and we'll raffle that off to get sort of people's attention. Or we also have signs that we're just giving away free stuff. And so our signpost in that setting is literally a signpost. And the idea is in a clinical setting, this would be asking permission to talk about firearm storage practices and suicide risk. So we have an assessment. In our case, it's a literal physical assessment we have people do. We have both a pre and post survey. I'll talk about the results of that later, in which people will describe their storage practices for firearms, medications, et cetera. We will share facts. I like to emphasize few facts. I find that when I am talking about a topic I know a lot about, I tend to fire hose people with information, and people that work in public health are the same way. So we try to minimize the amount of barraging. If you've ever been to a gun show, it's sort of like a county fair environment. There's a lot of people around. People's attention is pulled in a lot of directions. You can't necessarily afford to try to pin somebody down for 15 minutes talking about statistics. So few facts. Ironically, I spend a lot of time talking about that. Expect and validate emotion. Suicide is a fraught topic, and even though it's the elephant in the room that we don't necessarily discuss, a large number of people are personally touched by it, either having lost somebody, having had a previous attempt, something along those lines. So we like to tell our volunteers to expect and validate emotions, and then make a recommendation based on individual circumstances. So hypothetically, you're interacting with somebody that is into hunting and has two or three shotguns and a rifle, but they don't own any handguns. It would not make sense to offer them a pistol lockbox. Alternate solution, they don't have any medication. I'm not going to tell them to take a medication disposal kit. So we try to tailor the equipment that we provide to the individual user based on what they identify. And this is almost like an active listening exercise, so that they can tell that we're paying attention to them. We're trying to provide to them equipment that would help them the most. So these are the events we've done. We've done a large number of them. Originally, the state was funding us exclusively, and we were able to do roughly five of these a year. Our operational tempo has increased dramatically. We're doing roughly one of these on a monthly basis. This is ever since I was brought on board in July of last year. The ones I've highlighted in green are gun shows, and the other ones are a combination of military events and community settings, such as the National Night Out. We were able to support Walla Walla's last year, and we did the one in Island County just last month, it was earlier this month because it's on the 6th of August, so we just did that. We're moving in a much more deliberate military veterans direction as well. So Forefront recently hired my direct supervisor, who's Dr. Jessica Gallis. She joins Forefront after spending, several years at the Pentagon. So she worked for the U.S. Air Force as a civilian, but I joke that I was the diversity hire there, and that when I first came on board, I was the only male that worked at Forefront. I'm still the only prior service person, but she comes from a similar sort of background, and so both of us are moving very aggressively in that space. And since she also knows a lot of people from the Department of Defense, it's a little bit easier for us to get in the door on a lot of military installations. So we've done one at Joint Base Lewis-McChord for the U.S. Army. We did another one at the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve at Naval Station Everett, which was a really cool event, I might add. So this is the map of everywhere we've been. You know, we have been to Vancouver. We're actually here in November of last year, the Big Top Promos gun show at the county fairgrounds, which is one of the better ones we've done. It was very well attended. We had somewhere over 100 interactions, I think, which was actually a pretty good number. I can double check that off the top. I've written down 148, so that's a lot for us. So you'll note we have a pretty good geographic dispersion. My intent in doing this is to make sure that we are not only serving the greater Puget Sound region. This is for two reasons. One, we're a state agency. We owe it to the people of Washington State to serve them wherever they are. That's the intent behind the work. And two, the suicide rate is higher in rural areas. Urban settings typically have more of a problem with criminal violence, and there's an interesting displacement effect that goes on between those two things. There's that. So these are the trainings that we've done. There's a lot. The Boeing grant money, the Boeing company has stepped in, has been tremendously supportive, which is a big chunk of how we've been able to increase our op tempo. They have a specific intent that we provide the Learn training to veteran communities, specifically in educational settings. So you'll note a huge number with the Washington Department of Veterans Affairs. Two things about that surprised me. One, I didn't know that Washington had its own Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs. The joke I have is this department brought to you by the Department of Redundancy Department. And the others, I had no idea they have no organic suicide prevention capability, which shocked me. So they're in the process right now of hiring a statewide suicide prevention plan program specialist, thanks to legislation that we were able to get into the budget with our support. I was on the hiring panel for her. I think she's gonna work out. I think they finally made a hiring determination. So anyway, this is the trick, the community learn trainings. It's challenging to get approval to send me someplace remote in the state to talk for 90 minutes, just because I do have to be compensated, and it's a challenging allocation of resources. This is nowhere near as geographically dispersed as the actual events that we do. It is a challenge. We're working on it. I don't know necessarily what the pathway forward is, but that's what we've accomplished to date. So the evaluation we've done, I might or might not be the only layperson, non-faculty member to have gotten an IRB approval through the University of Washington, which is nightmarish, and I don't recommend it to anybody. If you've worked with IRBs in the past, the Institutional Review Board basically makes sure that anything with human experiments is ethical and not in danger of harming anybody. But it's thorough. It's extremely thorough. It's kind of like having a security clearance done. So we evaluate people prior to our interaction with them at the community setting military vendor gun show, and then several weeks following. So at the 4-week mark, we send out an email to them. Bear in mind, also, being contacted by us is entirely optional. The firearms owning community is deeply skeptical. The phrase being, like, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, doesn't necessarily make friends and influence people within the community. So it is optional entirely. I do need to have a waiver filled out that says you're not going to sue me if you lock your hand in the gun safe, but being a participant in this is optional. So that does sort of artificially diminish the number of participants that we have. It may not be reflective of literally every person that's filled out paperwork with us. So in the event that they consult, we send out an email survey at the 4-week mark. If they don't respond to that within a week of that, we send out another email. And then if they don't respond to that by a week after that, my friend Katrina, formerly one of my range safety officers at Bellevue Gun Club, now lives up in Fairbanks, Alaska as a trail guide and dog musher, but she's also working for Forefront to contact people over the phone. And having somebody who's dedicated to only do the phone calls has been a tremendous help for us, because that's incredibly time intensive and I hated every second of it. But it's also increased our response rate substantially. So this was as of a couple of months ago. This, I believe, is through the month of May. We've done 804 pre-assessments, 188 post-assessments. So the total response rate is 23.5%, roughly. Ever since January, when we brought Katrina aboard and had some additional manpower, thanks to the Boeing money, our response rate has radically increased. This actually caused some consternation at Harborview. They're thinking, like, did you change something significantly? Is the data skewed? Like, oh, we just have more people to actually do the work. So you can see that the actual results right there. We're monitoring, do people own guns? If so, how are they storing them? Same thing with medications. And then we have attitude and knowledge-based questions as well. You can see that there is a significant change from they keep all of their firearms locked up from 52% prior to our interaction to 68% following. So this does appear to be at least a somewhat optimistic looking change in behavior based on the fact that we've advised them about suicide risks, given them some plans of action for if they're in danger for themselves or others. Part of our interaction is also telling them things that they can practically do and advising them of different policies, such as the emergency transfer that we passed in 2017. So if you're not familiar with that, I'd be happy to talk more, but I do want to be respectful of your time. The area that is somewhat frustrating to me is nobody locks up their medicine. And even after our interaction, that's not a statistically significant change. Just people do not think about storing medicine the same way they think about storing firearms. With self-reporting anyway does have its own ups and downs, but at least self-reporting, something like 80% of the people we interact with in the settings report that if they own guns, they keep most to all of them locked up, but like nobody locks up their meds, just even after the interaction. So we'll probably need to tailor that a little bit better. The other thing that's interesting is if we look at the next about attitudes and everything, people start off highly confident about being able to help somebody who is at risk of suicide, and then after our interaction, their confidence level actually diminishes. And this led to some head scratching and consternation, but this is actually a normal behavior pattern. Within some of my other work, for example, if I'm training police officers, I'll ask their training sergeant, like, how good are your people? And so they're pretty good. And I was like, okay, objectively, how are they shooting on the CJTC qualification? Because pretty good is not an objective measure. People who have minimal knowledge or training are typically artificially confident, and then as their knowledge base increases, their confidence level diminishes. This is a normal pattern from what I am told to believe. So I'm not shocked by this, although there was some head scratching by some of our analysis folks. So the bottom portion right there, again, the knowledge that most firearm deaths are suicides, I really want to see that post number higher than that, but seeing a more than 10% jump is good. It's interesting in that in depending on the community that I'm talking to, if I'm talking to gun people, they will typically say that murders are the most common type, the street crime is the most common type of gun-related death. If I'm talking to a public health community, they will often say mass shootings, which is actually a very small percentage. If I'm talking to people in a professional capacity, members of the armed forces, police officers, et cetera, they typically say that accidents are the most common. And I suspect there's a degree of professional hubris associated with that. But the knowledge that suicide is overwhelmingly the most common cause or the most common type of firearm-involved fatalities is not widespread knowledge. Until we can increase the knowledge base on that, a lot of the other stuff we have doesn't necessarily stick as well as I'd prefer. So how we do everything, in the event somebody wants training materials, they can reach out to me via email. We have a contact section on our website. These are the things we actually distribute. This is the Liberty HD50. It's a pistol gun safe. It'll fit up to a 5-inch barrel service pistol, so 1911s, M9s, et cetera, Glock 17. It's a good quality product. It retailed for $35 off of Amazon, but everyone in the industry that sells these things has been tremendously supportive, and they sell us these almost near at cost. So we're purchasing for somewhere in the $12 to $13 range. Recently, the steel tariffs have sort of thrown that off, which wasn't been fun, but we still have a large number in backup. We also have products for rifles and shotguns. You can see we have one for ARs on the left-hand side. For those of you that are unfamiliar, the AR pattern rifle represents roughly one out of every five firearms manufactured in the United States. There seems to be a pervasive idea that these are uncommon, and that's just divorced from reality. Again, they're extremely common, and so having something that we can use to secure these is great. I was trying to find a different piece of equipment to secure these, because if you have something with optic mounted, it doesn't work. Of course, optics are a lot more common than iron sights anymore, but unfortunately, what I was trying to source is no longer made by the manufacturer, and I have to find something else, so I'm working on it. The one for shotguns is next to that, so any sort of tube-fed shotguns will work with, which is great. We have medication lock boxes, so if people say, I don't have anything to lock up my meds, I say, ha-ha, I've got a solution for you. Or I can joke, it's also the world's most secure lunchbox, so it has a little combination lock on top. And the cool thing is that the lid itself will actually fit on most prescription bottles. So if somebody just has like one bottle of prescription meds and they just don't keep medicine in the house, it'll still work for them to a degree. And the disposal kit we have, those were actually donated to us by Malincroit Industries. We didn't pay anything for them, which is magnificent. And so in the event that somebody doesn't know where a disposal site is, such as a pharmacy or police station, they have some way of disposing old unused medicine. So by the numbers, this is most current. This is as of, I believe, last week when I put this together. We've almost interacted with 1,100 people formally. I've been to 40 locations, and I've driven, at this point, over 4,000 miles in pursuit of this work. So we've done 56 online trainings. We provide a suicide prevention training to members of the industry, both instructors and retailers, so they can better find clients, either students or prospective customers, who may be at risk so they can identify behavior patterns like, I need to buy a gun. Oh, what kind of gun do you need? I don't care. How much ammo would you like? One round will suffice. These are sort of stereotypical jokes, but anyway. We've distributed hundreds and hundreds of locking devices, principally pistol safes. They're very popular. It is actually a really cool piece of equipment. I keep one in my truck. Roughly 170 or so of shotgun products, almost 160 of the rifle ones. And we've actually distributed those for about 3 months fewer, so they're actually going at a higher rate. And then a whole bunch of the disposal packets. I don't specifically know how many. The manufacturer did not label how many were in that case, so about four cases of those. This is the team, this is the task force itself, and the task force is defined by state statute passed in 2016. As per RCW 4374-45, we have two specific subcommittees. I was on the firearms subcommittee, there's also a pharmacy one. I have almost no visibility of what the pharmacy subcommittee is doing and has been doing. We also now have a specific mention of the construction industries and labor unions, which doesn't neatly fit into either of those two specific subcommittees. So I'm not totally sure how they're gonna rectify that with statute yet, but Lakeside Industries, Cal Buyer, has just been enormously supportive, and that man's a force of nature, so we're definitely moving heavily in that direction. Then there's the program. The program is done by Forefront Suicide Prevention. I am an employee of Forefront. So the task force decides what we're going to be doing and how, and then I implement it. That's that dichotomy more or less makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have a really broad number of partners. This is a small sampling of them. I believe by last count, there are about 46 different organizations that decided they wanted to contribute to the work. So we have a certain number of statutorily mandated positions. For example, we do have to have somebody from the Department of Health. We have to have two members of law enforcement, et cetera, two members of firearms industry, things of that nature. But we also have a huge number of other people that simply want to be part of the process that we have, and it is kind of unique. As you can see, we have the most heated rivalry. We have both Wazoo and UW on there, so sometimes people have mutually exclusive goals and objectives. This is my team. There's me. Morgan Meadows, our research assistant. Sam Powers has been helping us with practice, and she's putting together the manuscript for what we're hoping is going to be a paper. And then, of course, Jen is in charge of Forefront, and my direct supervisor is Dr. Jessica Gallus. So this is a sample that we have here. Again, I have plenty of that in the back. Feel free to take as much of it as you'd like. I don't need to return with any of it. Some of the lessons that we've learned, we have to work collaboratively. One of the ground rules we set in place early was, like, this is a big tent, and we are all focused on one singular thing. One of our key partners is the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, along with both the Second Amendment Foundation and the NRA. And if you think about gun rights advocacy groups and gun control groups, there's two sort of Venn diagram circles with a tiny sliver where they will overlap in the middle, and that's where we work. That is the area where we work. So we keep all the differences outside of that. Who is delivering the message is just as important as what the message is another of the key lessons that we've learned. So in a lot of settings, depending on where we're going, we might get pushback from unexpected corners, and having the right person there to be able to relay the information is very important. So if we're in a gun show setting, having somebody like me present, who is a firearms instructor, I've been doing that for a long time, works sometimes better than somebody who is a suicide prevention specialist. Whereas if I go to community health fair, again, I'm a knuckle dragger with a sort of weird looking beard, and I may not be as persuasive as somebody like my direct supervisor. So having a broad tent with people with diverse backgrounds is very, very important. Contacting people takes a lot of time. So if you are going to participate and work along these lines, be prepared to set up a phone bank, and it is miserable work. So if you can designate somebody to specifically work on doing nothing but contact people, that is the best way to do it, because me doing it as a one-man band was just completely unfeasible. We had this mountain of backlog, and I just couldn't ever keep up. Be prepared for frustrating and sometimes confusing pushback. Jeff Sung likes to joke that the party isn't done until everybody's offended. And so in a space that is, of course, fraught with controversy, be prepared for people to sometimes make your life harder than it needs to be. So be aware of that. If you're going to do an incentive in which you're going to say, we're going to give you a gift card if you participate, the gift card has to be more expensive than you want it to be. We have done the majority of our work without incentive. I think right now we're doing like a $5 Amazon gift card. I'm not going to get out of bed for $5. So if you're going to do some sort of incentive to get people to collaborate with you, like, you got to price at a point where it makes sense, but it might be cost ineffective to do. So just something to be aware of. And that's what I got. I hope I wasn't too wordy. So that's what I got.
Questions? Any questions?
I got more questions in terms of looking at the data. How much of a risk factor is alcohol with, you know, in combination in terms of, have you guys looked at that?
It's extremely high.
Is there some initiatives or something you're looking at in terms of alcohol and combination?
Not currently within the specific work that we're doing, although it might not be a bad idea. I know that the data that Seattle King County has provided to us shows that binge drinking is just as commonly associated with suicide risk as firearms ownership.
And then you put them in combination.
Yes.
I think those are questions we're asking on the behavioral uh-huh. risk factor survey. We're asking about firearm storage. I don't know if you're familiar with purpose.
I am, yes.
Uh-huh. And I think we're asking, on the same survey, we look at alcohol as well. It'd be interesting.
Correlation.
I don't know if that's a little hanging fruit or something we can work on.
Absolutely.
I was just telling Roxanne, sort of to piggyback off of that, the fact that you're putting it onto Burfus actually says you're going to be asking the question. Part of the broader, I pulled some of these slides from the cultural competency training we're doing for the VA, and just providers just don't really ask about firearms access. And one of the things that Jeff said as a clinician is, like, unless it's actually on the intake document, it isn't going to happen because you already have to do 8 zillion things. So the fact you're doing it is great.
Are you guys making suggestions for questions for Burfus at all, or are you involved in that process?
I don't think we got specifically about Burfus, but we have been talking about clinicians and asking.
Okay.
I'll bring it up to Jeff to see if that's something we want to make a recommendation for the VA.
Have you brought this to the WSMA at all or talked to them?
No, we have not.
Might be a good partnership there as well.
So you worked also, I think you've been in, did you mention to me that you were in Battleground and you work with the Prevent Coalition in Battleground?
Yeah, they provided the lion's share of our volunteers at the Safer Homes event that we did at the gun show last year. And they were, but your community is really, really engaged about all of this, by the way. Like, you can take your hand like this, pat yourselves in the back. Most communities that we interact with have nowhere near this much engagement, and they were stellar.
Yeah, they're wonderful. Yeah.
You also work with Kathy's district.
Yes. She is also a force of nature.
Well, other questions for Rush? Mm-hmm. I have one. So I listened to NPR, and they were talking about the New York City Police Department and they have a really high suicide rate among their police officers, and what they found is it was really hard to change the culture to, like, ask for help. And I was wondering if you encounter that a lot in your presentations also, just kind of, I know you said culture is still making this something that's not easy to talk about, but do you find that there's certain groups that have that response more than others?
That's sort of widespread. First responders, including police officers, are one of the professions with an elevated risk of suicide and a higher overall rate of suicide. And a lot of the professions seem totally unrelated. Like if I say members of the armed forces and first responders, you're like, well, I kind of get that. But then I throw in the veterinarians, the dentists, the lawyers, and the doctors, and you're like, I don't get it. The commonality is here, long training pipelines. So it's very challenging to get in that line of work. High degree of prestige, huge amount of stress and pressure combined with insular community. And as a result, it becomes harder for people to reach out because they don't necessarily want or are incentivized not to reach out of their own social circles to do so. If we're looking at, like, evidence of it getting better in certain areas, if that's the question you're asking, my personal experience being in and out of the Marine Corps since 2001, in 2001, 2002, it was like, if you had a mental health problem, you're not fit to lead, we're going to take your Marines away from you and we're going to sideline you. And anymore, you cannot go anywhere on base without, here's the de-stress hotline, here's the chaplain's number, suicide prevention, everywhere. It is literally in front of you on the urinal. Like, you cannot escape it. And that just doesn't exist in polite society. So in the, one of the just the way I'm, again, that's hopeful. At one point, the worst point that I was familiar with veteran suicide, when there were 22 a day on average that were taking their lives, we've gotten that number down to 20. After a tremendous amount of effort and investment of funds, there are areas where we can see we're making progress in changing that culture. The trick is the military, to a degree, is a monoculture. There is a, granted, if you ask, like, the Marine Corps culture is very different from the others. We're more of a cult than a culture. But there's still a commonality of terminology and purpose. And within a lot of other things, like, people that own guns don't necessarily have that much in common with each other. Rural firearms ownership typically has higher rates of hunting, and people that work in the hunting community are communicate with differently than people in the sport shooting community. Like, people are competitive shooters. The people that work at the Microsoft, or people that work for Microsoft that join their Microsoft Gun Club to shoot IDPA on Tuesday nights where I work, don't look anything at all like people live in Republic, Washington that go elk hunting every season. And so you wind up with a lot of different sub-communities, and you have to really kind of dive into those to see, like, how you talk to them. It's challenging. And the other part, when you get into professions too, like, the construction industry is very, very supportive. They're very aware of this. They love to highlight the fact that I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but they had, like, almost no single digits of workplace-related accidents resulting in fatality, but, like, 72 suicides a couple of years ago. And so they're very much acutely aware of, like, we need to get better at training our people to be able to reach out. Some communities have been more receptive than others, and it's going to be a heavy lift.
Any other questions for Brett?
I had a question. Are your volunteers at these events trauma-informed?
I will generally take whoever I can get. I'll put it that way. When Prevent Together Battleground showed up with like 20 people, I was over the moon because most of the time I'm doing this by myself. So it would be great if I could get people that had certain qualifications and whatnot, but one of them has to be, I need you to be in Republic, Washington over Memorial Day weekend. And you need to be able to interact in a gun show setting for 3 days standing on your feet on concrete. And it's like, it just gets to be too challenging. So it would be great if I could, but like, I can't guarantee it.
Maybe as more people become aware of trauma-informed principles, it may not be as difficult, hopefully, in the future to garner that kind of support. That would be great.
One can hope.
Yeah.
Have you done anything with the schools with regard to any of this work? And
we have two separate schools programs.
Can you talk a little bit about the school programs?
Not really. I'm not going to lie. I don't fully understand our higher education program.
Okay.
My colleague Marnie Lombard manages that.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to put in touch with her.
Right. Okay.
So the higher education program is a specific response to a state statute, SB 6514.
Okay.
And I am really unfamiliar with what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. The schools program we have for, I believe it's for high schools, and we might or might not have a middle school apparatus, does some postvention work. It also does some prevention work, but I'm really not familiar with the ins and outs of it. Those are separate things from me.
Okay.
I apologize.
No, I'll get in touch with you because I think that's another area where the FAC would be interested in learning a little bit more about. So maybe you and I can talk afterwards and we can provide some of that information back to them too. So.
Absolutely. And awesome. I can definitely put you in touch with their coordinators.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just have one more question. I'm sorry. So, because it's out of my sphere of interaction, so like hunting in Washington State is that a pretty consistent population, or is it something that's a declining number? Like, I rarely encounter people who eat game meat anymore, even though I grew up that's all we ate because we were hunters. But I have never run into anyone in Washington State that's actually a hunter. So is there a pretty consistent population?
It's shrinking, and that's we're seeing this nationally too. And okay. Washington's a particularly acute problem. Because a lot of how Department of Fish and Wildlife is funded is through the sale of hunting and fishing tags. The state parks are funded in no small part through that. Like nationally, like excise taxes on ammunition fund a lot of conservation efforts. And as populations become increasingly urban and decreasingly rural, and as the impacts of increased costs and regulation diminish the incentives to participate in hunting, it's shrinking. In Minnesota, for example, they've seen, I think, a 25% drop in people who have taken hunter safety classes from 2006 to present. That's rapid. Now, granted, it's Minnesota. It was a particularly, I think, acute case. But the population is shrinking. The demographics are changing. People that own firearms are now increasingly female and urban. The fastest growing demographic of people that purchase firearms is women under the age of 45. And again, we're looking at this point, it's more than 2 out of 3, it's 67 point whatever percent of firearm owners expressly own firearms for personal safety reasons. It's only about 38% that identify hunting as one of the major causes that they own guns. So if I could wave a magic wand and destroy a stereotype, it would be Elmer Fudd. Because Elmer Fudd decreasingly represents what the community is actually doing and what it looks like. No, is it consistent? It's shrinking. Maybe not as quickly as some other places, but it is shrinking.
So we have a lot of people that own firearms that don't actually generally use them.
Depends on what you mean by use.
I'm ignorant. So are there a lot of gun clubs? Is there a lot of shooting ranges? You know, I know golf courses are getting redeveloped, so I'm just wondering about a lot of this space is, as it gets more urban. Mm-hmm. If that's like an active community, or is that a pretty widespread, large base of community?
Oh, overall, Washington State has a higher than average rate of firearms ownership compared to the rest of the country. Again, we're about 3 to 6 points higher percentage wise in terms of per capita firearms ownership. That's true in most Western states, so we're not super out of line there. I worked an indoor shooting range in Bellevue. There are two in the city of Bellevue. indoor ranges are increasing in prevalence, specifically as the population becomes more urban and more affluent. We start seeing a rise with what they're sort of euphemistically calling gun tree clubs. So, for example, I like the chuckle. There's a group called the NSSF, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the gun lobby. People often erroneously call the NRA the gun lobby. Remember, the NRA represents the users. NSSF represents the industry. And NSSF has a series of accrediting standards. I'm proud of the fact I work at one of two five-star rated shooting ranges in Washington State. The other one's in Yakima, for example. And so as the consumer base becomes more urban and more affluent and younger, they want more and more amenities. But they're increasingly indoors as opposed to outdoors, especially as outdoor space becomes harder to come by and the population density diminishes. And then, of course, like lead standards are also a big concern. So you have to be in an area with a certain degree of economic activity to make it economically viable. And that might be a contributing factor why the hunting population is diminishing, because as ranges in rural settings shut down, there are fewer places for people to zero the rifles for hunting season. It becomes less and less convenient. Like, nobody wants to drive an hour to go to an outdoor range to zero for 200 yards for their elk gun so they can, for, you know, 2 weeks out of the year, then go do something. So as the demographics shift, it sort of becomes more and more like itself. It's a snowball. So we're seeing more indoor shooting. I think the NSSF, I'm not sure how they parse the data. I need to look into like where they're getting the numbers, but they showed the number of new shooters, being people that had shot either never before or fewer than five times previously in their life, increased 50-ish percent faster within the last 2 years as opposed to the previous 2 years. So it looks like people are getting more into it, but they're getting into different things, principally personal protection and competitive shooting. You're welcome.
You mentioned the little Venn diagram where there's a little sliver.
Yeah.
So what kind of, when you look at that little sliver, what kind of policy conversations might come out of that? If you were to look at where that common ground is and where you can start having those conversations and making them be productive conversations, where would you say that those conversations lie? I mean, what kinds of things are you looking at policy-wise?
Yes. First, we have, in my opinion, like the most beautiful picture of bipartisanship that I can think of off the top of my head. I will say that these things will shift over time.
Yes.
2 years ago, our extreme risk protection order statute was sort of like, I'm not that happy about it, but it wasn't particularly controversial. Now that, air quotes, red flag laws are like in the popular consciousness at the national level, now there's more controversy surrounding it. So these things can shift over time. So in direct answer to your question, the key thing, star-spangled, like shout from mountaintops, 2014, by ballot initiative 594, we criminalized the private transfer of firearms between individuals with very minimal exceptions. The unintended consequence of this was that we criminalized the best clinical best practice for treating suicidal patients with firearms, which is have somebody else hold one of the guns for you. The VA has a training video from like 1991, which is of course super cheesy and bad. Like, Ted, I see that you are at risk. I like your safety plan, but the one thing I'm worried about is the handgun. Could you have your brother-in-law hold on to it? And so that became illegal in 2014. And so we went to the legislature and we said, this is insane. So we basically locked the Alliance for Gun Responsibility and the NRA in a room and said, figure it out. And they did. So in 2017, we passed the temporary emergency transfer exception to our firearm transfer statute. So in the event that you are preventing imminent self-harm, you do not need to go through a licensed gun dealer to hold on to someone's guns. You can just do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. I've personally done this for three different people. And those calls typically come in somewhere between 11:30 and 2 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know if a single FFL was open in those hours. So again, telling people, like, by the way, if you're trying to help somebody do the right thing, there are only three standards. There are only three statutory requirements. It's temporary, like you're not giving somebody a gift. It's to prevent self-harm, and you don't use the gun. It's really simple. It's this beautifully simple thing in which there wasn't a huge fanfare around it. People don't know about it for whatever reason, probably because we didn't do this to get notoriety. We did this because it was the right thing to do. That was like the key thing, is like, where do we agree? We found where we agreed, said like, negotiate. They negotiated, and then we put it before the legislature, and I think it passed unanimously.
It's more like a data-driven response, though.
It's what?
It's a data-driven response. I mean, they look at
right. information around this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of policy is, and we were talking about this earlier, a lot of policy is passed with a huge degree of artificial urgency, in which people will respond with justifiable emotion to something, but this will lead to ineffective, short-sighted, or inaptly targeted policies. And then it becomes incumbent upon people further down the line to go through the even more challenging procedure of modifying those statutes. This was just an example in which it worked out as well as I think it possibly could have.
Great questions. Any others while we still have breath here? Well then, thank you very much for coming and sharing your knowledge and wisdom and experience with our council. We really appreciate it and appreciate you bringing some materials for us to take. And we're very grateful that you spent some time with us tonight. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll include a link to Safer Homes in the notes. There's also some, in addition to the handouts, you had a white paper that's, we didn't include in all of your packets, but there is a white paper up here if you are interested in taking that. That was also, oh yes, there you go. It's nice reading. I did read it. It's actually very interesting. So there's a few copies over there, but we'll also have that as part. Did we send that out already? Did we already send? We'll send it out again to you in the notes. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
Excellent. All right then. Well then, moving on to our agenda.
Our
first this is the opportunity for our council members to provide any announcements or sharing information. Anyone have something to do?
I'm not a council member, but can I share something? So, in line with what we're talking about, there's a Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network that's going to be held in Vancouver on November 6th. I don't have a date yet. I mean, I don't have a location yet, but as soon as I do, I'll let you all know. But again, it's called the Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network, November 6th. And as soon as I get more information, I'll send it out to you. Do you know me?
I do. May I?
Yes, please.
I've been to every one of their meetings except for the very first one. It's principally put on by Seattle Children's Hospital. Seattle Children's has probably the most functionally similar program to mine in that they do free gun lock giveaways. Theirs is emphatically for preventing child access. They did an event that I volunteered at here in Vancouver at the Sportsman's Warehouse October or something like that of last year. So well worth attending. There typically aren't as many people as I like. It's pretty neat. So they have I think usually about a half dozen presenters worth coming to.
Great. All right.
Yeah, we're doing child death review also.
Yep, we're doing child death review.
You may be able to mine some of the data from there around.
Yep. And our plan is to have them child death review is going to be on the agenda in the next few months. We've got some data that we're working on right now to share with you. We want to come back and share with you kind of the progress and what's come out of that. And again, the focus of that is not on prosecution, it is on prevention, looking at ways of preventing these tragedies from happening in the first place. So we'll be able to share some things that have come out of that. Some really good dialogue has been happening and they've got some great partners at the table. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Any other comments?
Anyone would like to share the order? Then I will call the meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.